You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 16th, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
We are a little bit more than a month away from leaving on our trip to New Zealand and Australia.
Is everyone ready?
Nope.
Totally packed and ready to go.
I was just talking to my wife today. You know, she's like, why are you so stressed out? Like, what the hell's going on? You know, she's like checking in with me, and I'm like,
Halloween's coming.
The trip, you know? Like,
I've
got so much on my plate with this, with the trip. Like, you know, we're like, you know what the biggest problem is, guys? I don't know if the rest of you guys know what Steve, me, Ian, and Courtney have been dealing with. Packing our gear. Because remember what happened the last time we went to New Zealand?
Like, oh, yes.
You can't have a carry-on bag heavier than 15 pounds. And my suitcases, my carry-on hard shell cases were 17 pounds. Empty.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a problem.
So I gave myself a full 2 months to like pre-pack. I mean, you know, it's been insane. I'm doing it all day tomorrow again, just making sure that we're right on the nose, because we were right above the nose, or whatever you call it. We were just over. Remember what happened, Evan?
Oh my gosh.
We were pulling, Kara, we had every one of us, it was like we just dumped out our carry-ons, and it was like, I'll take two of those and three of those. Like we were freaking out in the airport because we weren't going to make our flight, and the people
quite
no, but back up a little bit. This is what happened. In the U.S., the weight limit on suitcases is 50 pounds.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In Australia and New Zealand, it was like 20 kilos, and which is like 45 pounds. So suddenly, all of our bags are 5 pounds over. Right?
Well, not just that, Steve, but the carry-on bags themselves.
Well, I know.
They don't weigh carry-ons
in the U.S. They never weigh carry-ons.
Yeah, so we redistributed to our carry-ons so that our luggage wouldn't go over, and then we discover they weigh your carry-ons, which doesn't happen in the U.S. So now everything is overweight. And it was a disaster. In the middle of the airport with everyone's bags open, swapping stuff around. And we had to buy another bag, I think, we had to do something.
We ended up paying crazy. They got you at the airport when you're like late for your flight.
Yeah.
You know, they should literally have like a luggage vendor standing. Oh, you need a bag? It'll be $1,000, pal.
Guy pulls his coat open. Hey, you need one of these? Hey.
Yeah, the limit though is 50 pounds for the bags I know. So I don't know if they changed that to synchronize it with American baggage. So that was a pain. But New Zealand Air, 15-pound limit on your carry-on, because they don't want heavy bags falling out of the overhead compartments in a crash. And
I have to wonder,
is that really going to matter?
I think it's probably less about in a crash and more about just if you hit really rough air.
Yeah, I agree. But that's not what they said. They said in a quote-unquote crash.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, okay.
Well, that,
yeah. you would have survived the crash if it weren't for that 20-pound bag in the overhead compartment.
Plus, you got to pack light anyway because you're gonna buy something. You know, like you're not gonna, with all this stuff and places we're going, like something is gonna end up in my bag that I didn't fly out there with.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And, but we will be bringing swag with us, and hopefully we won't be coming home with it, and that will be the space for stuff that you buy there.
Good point.
So anyway, I guess they started this by saying that, yes, I am stressing out.
With a month to go.
Oh, there's just so many details on a trip this big. It's amazing.
Oh, gosh, with so many events that we're doing.
Yeah. Did you guys hear about the court case awarding $450,000 to one of the fathers of a child killed at Sandy Hook?
Yes.
For defamation. So... Mm-hmm. Two authors of a conspiracy mongering book claiming that no one was killed at Sandy Hook, that the whole thing was a hoax, was sued by one of the parents for defamation because he started getting death threats from people who were buying into the conspiracy mongering.
And so this wasn't Alex Jones. It was like another conspiracy that launched off of Alex's. Jeez. Oh,
yeah, that's so great. That is great. You know, just to put a sharp point on this. One of the fathers who lost his daughter committed suicide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really sad. Yeah.
And not just, you know, I don't know this firsthand, but even though, you know, we all live literally, Bob is in the town where it happened, and I'm one town away at this point. At the time, I was living in the town as well. But you've got to think that, you know, it's horrible enough to lose a child, but then imagine being harassed by people for a couple of years about the fact that your child didn't even exist.
And now, the two authors are Pulaski and Fetzer. He had one of them settled. The other, the award was against the other one, who says that they're going to appeal, right? But their defense was that the conspiracy is true.
Yeah,
right? That was their defense. Because in order to sue for defamation, you have to show that what they said was false. They had a, you know, either they knew it was false or had a disregard for whether it was true or not, and that it caused harm. I think the harm is pretty easy to demonstrate in this case.
But they had to prove that it was false.
Well,
they failed to satisfy that.
In other words, they did prove that it was false. The conspiracy theorist claimed that it didn't happen, that his statements were true, and they weren't able to demonstrate that the statements were true.
Yeah, exactly.
The jury didn't buy the conspiracy. Yeah, just to be clear, it didn't buy the conspiracy. And
but how sad to, again, like, we're talking about re-traumatizing over and over.
I know.
Oh,
like, having to sit there and defend the fact that your child was murdered.
Yeah.
And this guy was, like, engaging with the conspiracy theorists, trying to get them off his back. He actually published the birth certificate of his child to show that he really existed. And then they just claimed it was fake, and they came after him even more. And then he realized that this was just in a spiraling out of control. He had no way of containing it. And they were harassing him, you know?
Yeah, it's terrible that he has to relive that. But this is a great precedent. I mean, almost $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, that hopefully that will give other, you know, other conspiracy loons.
Mongers.
Peddlers,
mongers.
You know, some pause, hopefully, peddlers in the future.
This is where, you know, correct me if you don't agree, guys, or if you think I'm wrong, but this is, to me, where the court system falls completely flat on its face. Like, do we really have to go through the absolutely ridiculously expensive and super time-consuming and amazingly stressful process of putting this man or these families into a courtroom and have to go through all that rigmarole? Like,
the answer is yes, and I'll tell you why.
Why?
So, first of all, he's suing them. This father chose to sue them for defamation. So he initiated the lawsuit.
Yep. It's not a countersuit.
No, he initiated he initiated a defamation lawsuit against the conspiracy theorist. So it's on him if he's doing that. I mean, it's not saying it's justified, you know, in my opinion, from everything that I'm reading, but he is initiating the lawsuit. Now, with defamation suits, there needs to be a way to quickly get out of it if the suit is baseless. But if the suit is not baseless, if you go all the way through to the end where someone's being awarded hundreds of thousands of dollars, yes, that has to take a long time. The what shouldn't take a long time is getting a verdict of there is no defamation, especially if the case is flimsy, right? Or superficial, you know, or just like a harassment lawsuit. Those are the ones that need to end quickly. But if there's merit to the case, and it goes all the way through to a jury judgment, yeah, that's going to take a long time. There's no way around that.
Okay, well, I get that.
By definition, there was no short circuit. There was no escape hatch. You had to go through discovery. You had to go through all the preliminary stuff. In the end, you have to go through a jury trial. It's just that's what it is. That's what it's going to be. Just to be clear, but when we talk about like quickly dealing with defamation suits, we're talking about slap suits, you know, the harassing ones. It shouldn't take years and hundreds of thousands of dollars to defend yourself against a frivolous, harassing suit. But if it has merit and you get awarded money, then yeah, that's going to be the full thing. And I know some people will say, well, this is a freedom of speech thing, but, you know, defamation is a recognized exception to freedom of speech. You do not have the freedom to ruin somebody's life by lying about them. That's the bottom line. Yeah. And that seems to be what was happening
here. Right, or causing a scenario by which other people wind up threatening your life and the life of your family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so sad that the family has to go through the double trauma. You know, it's bad enough. I mean, you can't imagine the trauma of losing a child to violence like that at that age. Oh, my God, unimaginable.
Yeah.
But then to have to live with the harassment by nutcases for years after that, oh, God.
It'd be hard to control myself.
Yeah.
Well, this
don't even want to know what I'd be capable of in a situation like that. I really don't.
You don't want to be tested, right? Exactly.
No, wouldn't be pretty. All right, let's go on with the show. Kara, you're going to give us a what's the word. It's been a while.
Word.
It's been a very long time. And so I'd been keeping a list of kind of contenders that people send in, things that come up during the show. And one of the words that I feel like has come up a few times that we've never really done a deep dive is we'll usually use it as an adjective, leucistic. So the noun form would be leucism. Steve, something, I feel like you sometimes talk about this when we talk about birds. Light.
Yes, because birds that have leucism means like they're an albino, but they could also have partial leucism, where they might get one of the genes is has a mutation for the that is for albinism, and but not the other one. So they like there was actually a cardinal in my backyard for a number of years that had partial leucism. Yeah, I don't see him around anymore, so I assume they were past their life expectancy. But for a few years, yeah, it was very cool looking. And you'll see them all the time. Like once you start looking at birds, like if you're a birder and you look at birds all the time, you'll see birds with leucism or partial leucism all the time.
Yeah, so, you know, partial leucism, that's an important point. You'll see that sometimes you'll get like a mottled kind of speckly, or you'll have like portions of the skin or fur or feathers that are only white. But an interesting thing, I was wondering when I first started to dig into this, like, is it the same thing as albinism?
No, it's not technically the same. It's a partial loss, not a complete loss. Albinism, I think, is a complete loss.
No, actually, this is an even more interesting distinction.
Oh, okay.
In albinism, you don't produce melanin, but in leucism, you don't produce melanocytes. So it actually can lead to different outcomes. So melanocytes are the cells or melanophores within the cells that actually hold the melanin. The melanin is the pigment itself. The melanocyte or the melanophore within the melanocyte is like the sort of like a vacuole, right? Like a little space where the melanin goes. So in albinism, they don't make melanin, but the cells are still present, or the little spots within the cells are still present. So if they have other pigment producing types like xanthophores or something, they'll hold on to those pigments. Whereas in leucism, they don't even have those types. So in leucism, you'll often see that they are whiter. In albinism, sometimes they'll be a little yellow. So you might see a difference there. And also interesting, in leucism, their eyes are usually normal.
Yeah.
But in albinism, you're usually going to see pink, red, or like baby blue eyes because they don't have any pigment in their eyes either. Also, here's something interesting. Kind of on the other extreme end of that, you have something called melanism. Mm-hmm. So just like you were saying, what species of bird was the leucistic bird that you were seeing hang out a lot?
A cardinal.
A cardinal. Okay. So I'm not sure how common a melanistic cardinal would be, but you see it often in mammals. Like if you look at the wiki page for it, you'll see like a melanistic guinea pig and a melanistic gray squirrel. But they have like some silkies, some pictures of beautiful silkies where they're black because they overproduce the pigment.
Wow. Yeah,
I didn't know that.
It does occur in cardinals. You could find pictures of
it. It does. Yeah. Oh, cool. And then... not to be confused melanism with melanosis, which is also not to be confused with
halitosis.
No. Yeah, don't confuse those things. With skin cancer. One type of skin cancer is called
melanoma.
Thank you. Melanoma, melanosis. Don't confuse them, but they're both kind of in the cancer family, right? So we think of melanoma as a common type of skin cancer of these melanin producing cells, melanocytes. But melanosis is when there is a deposition of this black pigment in the form of a pigmented tumor, which is pretty interesting. So there's all sorts of different variations of coloring, like when coloring goes awry in animals. So there are different words that we've probably mentioned before, like heterochromia, where they've got two different colored eyes, dyschromia, things like that. You've seen vitiligo in human beings, where there's those white splotchy changes to the skin. But apparently leucism and albinism, which is actually pretty hard to tell if you see an animal in the wild, is that an albino animal or a leucistic animal? You may not know unless you look at its genes. But it really is something different that causes them. So yes, At the very beginning, Bob, what did you say when I said the word leucistic?
Light, something to do with light.
Light, right? So the root, the ultimate root, if you go back, is...
Oh, I know, is Lucifer. Lucifer, Lord of Light.
There you go.
That's all you know, Bob.
That's all you know.
Yep. And that's all you need to know.
That's all you need to know. So Luke, and actually sometimes leucistic is written leucistic, and it may, I'm not sure if it's ever pronounced that way, but sometimes it's written with a K instead of a C.
Yeah.
If you go back enough, the PIE, remember the Proto-Indo-European root of Luke, means light or brightness. So you said Lucifer, elucidate.
Mm-hmm. Ineluctable.
Ineluctable.
Ooh, I love that word.
Mm-hmm. Luminary, luminate, luminescence.
Luminosity.
Lunar.
Oh, that's something.
Yeah, lumosity. even things like leukocytes or leukemia.
Lucid.
These are white cells, lucid. So
yeah, leukocytes.
Yeah. Yeah, bright, light, translucent. You can see through it. So yeah, it's a really cool root that you hear in all sorts of different words. And it speaks to, yeah, leucism in animals. Google leucism. Leucistic animal, and you'll see all sorts of cool stuff. They're beautiful.
Yeah, Kara, since you bring up cardinals, thanks, by the mm-hmm. way, there was a, every year or so, you see pictures online of somebody spotting a yellow cardinal, and that's a mutation, you know, that causes cool. that. It's one in a million, you know, so there's one in a million
that,
cardinals.
Is that like the blue lobster?
Right. Yeah.
Oh, wait. And I think I saw that type of mutation, too. It's not leucism. It's amelanism. So it's not the same as albinism. It's a genetic loss of tyrosinase function. And you see it in birds, reptiles, amphibians, and fish, sometimes in mammals. And it's when they have this like yellower. So you'll see like a quote unquote albino python, which is actually an amelanistic python. And so it's yellow and white. And so that may be your cardinal, too. There's even amelanistic cockatiels that are bred, like the white-looking cockatiels with yellow heads and the little pockets on their faces. So pretty interesting. There's so many different variants.
All right. Thanks, Kara.
Yep.
Jay, so I hear that NASA is finally getting some new spacesuits.
That's right. NASA unveiled two new spacesuits on Tuesday, October 15th. That was yesterday to us. And these suits, guys, are vast improvements on the existing spacesuit technology. So if you look back on like the Mercury and Apollo missions, we didn't have a lot of information at the time about what the astronauts would need in a spacesuit. You know, there wasn't, you know, it just didn't exist before that. And the first spacesuits were actually they were derivative of a test pilot suits that flew into the upper atmosphere. So they were taking something that was never really intended to go into outer space and kind of souping it up to make it, you know, more formidable. Beyond that, we had no information on what the real requirements were going to be. So today we're using, what is it, like, you know, 60 plus years of spaceflight experience and packing as much technology and enhancements as they could into these new designs. Now, as a reminder, the last time someone was on the moon was 1972. And today we're developing these spacesuits, and we're going to be using them in 2024. So they will be built with technology that exists today and the technology that will be developed probably over the next couple of years. And then they're going to be testing them on the International Space Station, which is really cool because we actually have a facility to test spacesuits on that's relatively safe. So there's two suits. We have the first one is the Orion Crew Survival System, or the OCSS. This suit is a flight suit that's intended for launches and for re-entry and also for critical maneuvers that might pose a threat to the astronauts. This is the orange-looking suit. If you look them up online, you'll see the two different kinds. This is the orange one. It's orange because, as an example, if an astronaut ends up in the ocean because of a re-entry that didn't go the right way, they want to be able to easily see them. So it's just for visibility reasons. This is a custom fit suit optimized for mobility.
Jay, does that mean that it's fitted to one specific astronaut?
Yes. Yep. Okay. This is the one that in the past, like if you see people walking onto the spacecraft and they're carrying a case with them, like a suitcase or luggage, that's not luggage. That's their oxygen. This is one of those. This is for takeoff and reentry, and like I said, some maneuvering. So the astronauts wear this, you know, just only during critical moments, and then they can take it off, and then they're you know, out of a spacesuit while they're doing most of the mission. It was created for improved comfort and function. It's lighter, stronger, has multiple sizes to accommodate men and women, and then these will be custom fit down to the individual at that point. They're much, much more flexible, allowing to have better reach. It's more fire resistant, or they said it's fire resistant. So I don't know to what degree, but of course, with modern technology and textiles that we have today, it's much, much more fire resistant than past suits. It's a pressurized suit with a re-engineered zipper that allows the astronauts to get in and out quicker. It has improved thermal management to keep the astronauts cool and dry. The pattern of the suits has been updated to get rid of these typical places that the previous spacesuits had that flat out just hurt the astronauts. If they wore them too long, there was pressure points and places where they were being pinched. You know, what are they going to do about it? Like develop a new spacesuit? Well, you know, they did. If they complained, and I'm sure they did, nobody was doing it, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. The gloves are much more durable than previous generations, and they are actually touchscreen compatible. The boots are more fire resistant. They'll fit better. They'll allow much more dexterity out of the astronauts. If the spaceships were to lose atmosphere, these suits could actually keep the astronauts alive, and the suits could be worn up to 6 days. Wow, that's fantastic.
Jay, I have to wonder, you talk about the fire resistance.
Yeah.
If the astronauts in Apollo 1, that, you know, where three astronauts died because of a fire in the cockpit, would they have survived if they had these suits?
I thought of the same exact thing, Steve. I couldn't find anything. My gut says probably not, just because of how unbelievably bad that oxygen fire was.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Do we have suits today that can really withstand being in those temperatures for a sustained amount of time? It's a good question.
Yeah, I think if I recall, they suffocated. That's how they died. It wasn't like from the heat from the fire necessarily.
The lack of oxygen burned out and couldn't breathe.
Just the smoke. Yeah, they just couldn't breathe.
So we could find out, and we could follow up with that. I'd really like to learn more about it. These suits also come equipped with a lot of cool doodads, like a life preserver with a personal locator beacon, a knife, a strobe light, a flashlight, a whistle, a light stick, and a signaling mirror that allows them to, you know, to flash that. This is all for if they end up in the water. Now, the Exploration Extravehicular Mobility Unit, or the XEMU, this is the one that kind of looks like the one that you're typically seeing that the astronauts were wearing on the moon. It has that same kind of shape and everything, but vastly updated. Now, this is designed, as I said, for extravehicular activity, which means you're outside of the spacecraft for spacewalks or walking on the moon surface or other planets. The spacesuit is actually considered to be a self-contained personal spaceship. Now, think about that. That is so cool. It's a one-person spaceship at this point.
But does it have propulsion?
Well, I'm sure that they can add exterior components to it, like they'll hook into something, right? You know, but the suit that I'm talking about right now is a self-contained habitat. Look at it that way.
Habitat is probably better than spaceship. Yeah.
Now, these suits will be one size fits all because they're extendable. So they start with common elements, and then they can just add on more sections to make the arms longer and the torso longer if they need to. These suits will allow the astronauts to actually walk like they would on Earth, or much more like they would on Earth. Now, if you remember footage from earlier moon missions, the astronauts would hop. You know, most of us thought that was because of the way that they were told to walk around, or they probably were instructed to move around that way, but it was really a limitation of the spacesuit. Today, the suits that they're developing now, they're going to have more of a normal stride, which will probably be odd when we finally see them walking around on the moon. It's going to be more like they're on Earth. So guys, these spacesuits have what they're calling an unlimited capacity to absorb carbon dioxide. Now, for those of you who haven't read about this, how do you think these suits are able to handle an unlimited amount of carbon dioxide?
They have a ventilation system.
Right, Evan. They outgas it. They shoot it. Kara's like, I don't know.
That seems easy.
They have a way to capture it, and then they outgas it. They're designed to keep out lunar dust, because now we know a lot about lunar dust. They can handle massive heat variations from minus 250 to plus 250 degrees Fahrenheit, or minus 156 to plus 121 Celsius. Since modern electronics are so much smaller, there's now system redundancy. So like, you know, an entire system can break down. Well, they've got backups now, which is great. The backpack is the life support system. It powers the suit. It holds oxygen. It removes toxic gases, odors, and moisture from the suit, regulates temperature, monitors performance, and issues warnings, which is great. And basically, it's a high-efficiency filter and heat exchange system. I mean, perspiration passes through the first layer. This is gathered in the second, where salt is separated. Breathing and walking provide the pumping action. The reclaimed water circulates to catch pockets from which they can drink through a tube at their neck. Urine and feces are processed in the thigh pads that could be sustained for, you know, weeks in the desert.
Wow.
It's like a still suit. Like a still
I just suit. Read that that's yeah. the copy from the still suit. You didn't recognize it. Everything I said from basically it's a high efficiency filter and heat exchange system was from Dune. That's fake.
Okay. Dune 2020.
I thought at the very least that. Steve would recognize it.
I did. I said it's like a still suit.
All right. So I just want to make sure the audience knows that though that last big sentence that I said was all fake.
Oh, good, because that's gross.
Yeah, so where it says regulates temperatures, monitors performance, and issues warnings, that's real. So the new suits can be repaired to a certain degree in outer space. This is a great feature. For example, if the visor gets scratched or dented or whatever, they can swap it out for a new, you know, a new mask if they need to, and they don't have to send it back to Earth and have it be repaired. Now, I don't know to what degree, but it really is smart that they were thinking in a modular way, right? So they send up a whole bunch of these modular pieces, which I'm sure they're already know, like, okay, if person X is in it, this is how you construct your suit. But then they'll have redundant pieces on the ship, components that they can click back in if something happens. Brilliant. Great work, NASA. I've been dying to see the new suits, right? When SpaceX came out with their new, their suit was more of like the one you wear in the spaceship. It's not one for extra vehicular activity. You know, their suit looked really cool. I wonder if SpaceX is going to use their suit or the one that NASA has made, but the NASA ones are legit. They're prototyped and they're in the last stages of testing. So they're going to be, you know, these suits are going to be probably fully ready to go, you know, months before the ship takes off. In 2024.
Yeah, they look neat. The bulky ones, I mean, the backpack is still huge.
So, Steve, when I said urine and feces are processed in the thigh pads, it didn't like occur to you the whole thing was a joke?
I don't think he was listening that closely.
No, I was a little behind. I was processing what you were saying. Then when you said, wait, you could drink from the thing, it was kind of adding up. I got it. Yeah.
The reclaimed water circulates in catch pockets from which they can drink.
Dune.
Talking about techno-optimism, this leads to my news item, which is about recycling nuclear fuel.
Yeah. Oh boy. Didn't we just talk about this?
This is a new study, which they demonstrate the entire process on actual spent nuclear fuel, showing how it can be recycled. Now, I've been reading about nuclear power plants for years now because we've been reporting on it every now and then. And I learned something new in this item. This is complicated. And you realize how often what's actually happening is getting oversimplified for the reporting, even technical reporting that's made for a general audience, right? The real technical stuff is way over your head. But anyway, so you guys know about, you know, nuclear power plants, basically, right? So it's fission. You start with enriched uranium, and it has to be at, you know, a certain grade. Not as purified as weapons grade, but it has to be at a certain grade in order to burn as fuel in a nuclear power plant. And at the end of that process, you have used nuclear fuel, right? Or they call it UNF, or used nuclear fuel. And so it's no longer capable of being used as fuel.
That's the same as when people say spent.
Yeah, spent nuclear fuel or nuclear waste is the colloquial term for it. Yeah. In the research that I'm reading, they use the term used nuclear fuel, UNF.
Gotcha.
One of the controversies of nuclear power is what do we do with all of the nuclear waste, right? It has to be stored for hundreds of thousands of years before the half-life of the components will get down to basically background radiation levels, or what they say, like basically the same radioactivity as uranium ore. So to get to that point, it takes hundreds of thousands of years. So that's the real controversy. Where are we going to put it that it's going to be safe for that long?
In the sun.
And until it'll take
actually,
that
it's
too
a bad
expensive.
Idea.
Yeah, it's better. And it's a lot of it, you know. So the idea is that with the next generation, the Gen 4 nuclear power plants, they would be able to burn reprocessed waste from the older nuclear reactors.
Right? Good.
But we have to be able to process it for that to happen. I didn't realize that that wasn't a done deal already, but apparently it wasn't. But now these researchers have demonstrated the process that does something extremely useful to the used nuclear fuel. They came up with a scalable, cost-effective, and like almost 100% efficient process of separating out what are called the minor actinides, or MAs, americium, curium, and neptunium. Right, so these are a minor component of the used nuclear fuel, but they have extremely long half-lives, these minor actinides. And then the bulk of the used nuclear fuel is the rest of like the uranium and other things as well. So here's the thing. Here's the critical bit. The minor actinides, the three that I mentioned, those are the ones that have the long half-life that need to be stored for hundreds of thousands of years. If you remove them from the used nuclear fuel, what's left will only needs to be stored for hundreds of years.
Hmm.
Like at oh, most. So if you basically had a storage facility that was rated for 1,000 years, that's more than enough, right? That's above sort of the upper limit of what would be necessary for the half-life to bring it down to background radiation levels. So that's a pretty big difference, hundreds of thousands of years to 1,000 years, you know, at the upper end, or just basically just hundreds of years. But it gets better, right? So first of all, if we separate those two things out, we have the bulk of the waste, which now is a lot easier to store. And it's easier to store for two reasons. One is that, again, the half-life takes it down to hundreds of years, but also it doesn't get nearly as hot. And so it's just easier to contain. We don't have to design containment, you know, barrels that will can stand the heat of the other elements. The minor actinides, the ones that have a long half-life, that's physically a much smaller portion of the nuclear waste. So now we could deal with them separately, and they're a lot easier to deal with because it's just the volume is a lot smaller. So those we can, you know, seal the crap out of that and put them into long-term storage. But there's a lot less of it, so it's a lot easier to deal with. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
It does.
Yes.
But it gets better than that because some of the Gen 4 nuclear power plant designs can burn the minor actinides as fuel. And in so doing, convert them to short half-life isotopes. That's where you, quote-unquote, burn the waste of the older power plants,
nuclear reactors.
In fact, this has some massive advantages. First of all, it gets rid of the worst component of the nuclear waste. There's now no long-acting nuclear waste because you're burning it all, everything down to only the short half-life waste. Also, you get a lot more energy out of your starting nuclear fuel, right? In fact, it allows you to recycle 95% of the fissionable material.
Nice.
So it's essentially extending the utility of, I don't know exactly how much the energy works out to be, but it's like basically on the order of magnitude of 20 times as much use out of the original nuclear fuel. But also think about it this way. With this process, separating out the minor actinides, we could use that and run the Gen 4 nuclear power plants entirely on the spent nuclear fuel from the older plants. We don't even have to mine more uranium ore. And that will generate our current level of nuclear power for a couple of hundred years, or more, which is, I think, probably going to be more than enough until other technologies make nuclear power obsolete. So that would be the best case scenario, right? We take all of the long-acting, difficult-to-deal-with radioactive material out of spent nuclear fuel, and we burn that in newer plants. It's all the fuel that we need for centuries, and we deal with all of the we work our way through all of the backlog of nuclear spent nuclear fuel. We could, you know, do this processing on all of it up front, store the short half-life stuff in Yucca Mountain or whatever, or even someplace easier. It doesn't have to be in some place that's going to be geologically stable for hundreds of thousands of years. It'd be a lot easier to store it. And then the rest, the stuff that's hard to deal with, we just burn that as fuel for the new reactors. So the researchers who published the study are claiming they actually tested this process on actual waste from, you know, spent nuclear fuel, and it worked. And they said it's scalable, it's cost effective, it's effective. You know, it's like not greater than 99% in terms of how much of it it's able to remove. So if it all works out, you know, like once the industry takes a look at it, you know, if it is something that could actually work, this essentially could be the way that we deal with our nuclear waste problem. And be a huge boon to Gen 4 reactors.
What a great solution.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are the implications for the nuclear industry, right? It remains to be seen. There's a lot of questions still remain. The big problem is that we have yet to actually, you know, anyone in the world to operate a Gen 4 nuclear plant. So they're still theoretical at this point. So we have to wait until somebody actually, you know, either China, I think, is probably going to be the first one to bring a Gen 4, you know, power plant online. And the industry is going through a tough transition right now because essentially the renewable energy is so much more cost effective. And they have to sort of make the case that say, yeah, it's more cost effective now, but in 10 or 20 years, you're going to hit the limit. And that's when you're going to need nuclear to get rid of the remaining coal and natural gas. Mm-hmm. But that requires thinking 10 or 20 years ahead.
Right.
That's where I think the problem is. The problem is not with the technology. It's going to be people are going to gobble up the cheap, the low-hanging fruit now. And then in 10 years or 15 years, we're getting to like 50, 60% penetration of renewables. And then we realize that, okay, we don't have the grid storage for this. We don't really have a grid storage option that's going to be at a level that we need. Even with wind and solar getting cheaper, they become less and less cost effective when you start to get to higher penetration. And it's like, oh shit, I wish we started building these Gen 4 plants 10 years ago, yeah, right? Mm-hmm. And I almost guarantee you that's the conversation we're going to be having in 2030. It's like, why didn't we start building these plants in 2020?
Because we're damn short-sighted, that's why.
Yeah, but we'll see. That's what I predict is going to happen, but we'll see. Hopefully, now, you know, like in the U.S., we get, you know, I've read 20%, I've read 30%, somewhere in there, 20 to 30% of our electricity comes from nuclear power plants, but they're aging, and most of them are at the end of their lifespan, and they need to be extended. So, like, we need to extend our existing nuclear power plants for 10 years, and we need to start building those Gen 4 plants that are much safer, smaller, more modular, more scalable. They're easier to ramp up and down, and they'll burn all that nuclear waste that we have sitting around the old nuclear power plants. Because we haven't actually moved the nuclear waste into long-term storage. It's most of it is just sitting in pools right on the site where they were used at the nuclear power plants. It's a real problem.
This sounds like such a no-brainer. Like, why isn't this happening?
I think because there just isn't the political will to do it, is the bottom line. I think you have, you know, on the right, people are happy to burn coal and gas, which is cheaper. And on the left, they want renewables, which is cheaper for now. But if you're planning out the next 20 years, like, what's our plan? How are we going to get to a decarbonized energy infrastructure?
Yeah.
I think the experts that I've read, that I've listened to, that make the most compelling case say, we're not going to get rid of coal and gas in the next 20 years without nuclear. That they make a pretty strong case for that, and that I find compelling. And the counter argument that people give against nuclear comes down to nobody wants it. There's no political will for it. It's not going to happen. Not that it doesn't work or it's not a good idea. Which I don't find a very compelling argument. It's like, yeah, we should use the science and the engineering and make an argument and muster the political will. If you are serious about decarbonizing our energy infrastructure, this is our best bet is to do everything, right? Is to pursue every technology which can phase out as quickly as possible coal and gas, mm-hmm. starting with coal, and not put all our eggs in any one basket. Because if the renewable strategy is counting on grid storage, we don't currently have. You can't say, well, we don't have Gen 4 reactors yet. It's like, I agree with that, but we also don't have the kind of grid storage we need to have full penetration of wind and solar. And honestly, I think working Gen 4 reactors are more likely than having the kind of electrical grid upgrade. That's the other thing. We need a massive upgrade to the grid, and we need grid storage in order to make that work.
Gosh.
We should do both and just hope that, you know, the more things that we do, the greater the probability that we'll decarbonize our infrastructure to minimize the effects of global warming. If we put all our eggs in one basket, and that doesn't work out, or it takes 20 years longer than we thought it was, we're screwed, because we're not going to, in 10 years or 20 years, you know, again, I don't want to be at that point, because that's what they're saying now. It's like, oh shit, we should have started building these new, you know, reactors 10 years ago. Then they're going to say that 10 years from now. It's like perpetually, the perpetual argument of why not to start building it, because we should have done it earlier. All right, Bob. I understand that the middle of our galaxy blew up.
Wait, when?
Well, Steve, it appears that something big happened about 3.5 million years ago at the center of our galaxy, and it irradiated a cloud of gas 200,000 light years away. So what happened? Can it happen again? And can it irradiate Earth? But that is pretty amazing, though. You know, we have a black hole in the center of our galaxy. It's called Sagittarius A star, but it's relatively small, only 4 million solar masses. I know that sounds like a lot, but there's black holes out there that are billions, supermassive black holes, billions of solar masses. So ours is just a little piker, and many of them are actively gobbling up gas and stars and releasing lots of X-rays from the friction of the intensely hot accretion disk. But Sagittarius A star is typically very quiescent. It's sometimes it brightens a little bit, very briefly, and then it goes away really fast. So it's interesting to think that at some point in the past, the relatively recent past, you know, 3.5 million years ago is nothing, that it was much more active and gregarious, if you will. It's interesting to consider that and to see what those ramifications are. So this study was published in the Astrophysical Journal by researchers Joss Bland, Hawthorne, and colleagues, from the ARC Center of Excellence for All Sky Astrophysics in Three Dimensions in Australia. So the story started in 2013, and now with the latest evidence from Hubble, the confidence has really risen even further that some extraordinary event happened 3.5 million years ago at the center of our galaxy. And for 300,000 years, it sent out this radiation in waves, and irradiating a huge cloud of gas called the Magellanic Stream. Have you guys heard of the Magellanic Stream? Now, you probably heard of the Magellanic clouds, right? The clouds. The clouds are basically two dwarf galaxies orbiting our galaxy, or co-orbiting. We're orbiting around them as well. But they're very low. They're low mass. They're relatively close, on an order of 100 to 200,000 light years away. Now, behind them, though, is a huge gaseous filament, and that's the Magellanic Stream. It's gargantuan. It's just an immense filament of gas arcing over half of the Milky Way. This is really big. The evidence that we have was first gathered in 2013 when astronomers reported the discovery of a special frequency of light known as hydrogen alpha emissions coming from a section of the Magellanic Stream directly in line with certain structures in our galaxy, so-called gamma ray Fermi bubbles. I don't need to go into too much detail about those bubbles. They're fascinating and beautiful. I talked about them quite a while ago. Now that light is evidence that a huge amount of radiation hit the cloud 3.5 million years ago. And the best explanation seems to be what they're calling a Seyfert flare, which is essentially an eruption of energy from an actively feeding black hole. And I want to try to put into perspective, you know, just how much energy we're talking about here. Some estimates go from 10 to the 56th to 57 ergs, which is equivalent to 10 to 50 joules. So in terms of joules, you could say that 10 to the 5 times 4 times 10 to the 41 joules is a lot. That's the theoretical total mass energy of the Earth. So basically convert all of Earth to energy and you'd have still a fraction, you know, a tiny, a good-sized chunk
of what happened in the center of our galaxy, or 5×10^43 joules, which is the total energy of all gamma rays in a typical gamma ray burst, which is a lot. And I couldn't find anything exactly 10^50, but the closest 5.4×10^47 joules, the mass energy emitted as gravitational waves during the merger of two black holes, 30 solar masses each. So yeah, a lot of energy. So essentially what you have, what it seems like what had happened is that you have two expanding cones near the galactic core, expanding outwards, right, above and below the plane of the galaxy. And it's this ionizing radiation that fried the gas in the Magellanic Stream many, many thousands of light years away. Now, there wasn't much reported as to, you know, what exactly caused this. I know they say it's a Seyfert flare, but try to find more information. What do you guys think could have done that? Something that you may have heard about.
I think there was a fight between two black holes. Like, they just had enough of each other.
Yeah.
And they just exploded with anger.
Yeah, that does tend to happen. I don't think there's too much evidence for that in our galaxy 3.5 million years ago. But I guess some people are saying that it could be the relativistic jets from an actively feeding black hole, right? You've seen the beautiful jets emitted by some black holes that are feeding. And that would be powerful enough to produce this effect. At least some of these researchers are saying. You may be wondering, you know, what was visible from the Earth 3.5 million years ago. Our Australopithecus ancestors were walking around, so they may have actually seen some of this radiation, some of the light that was coming. Now, it wasn't directed towards us because it basically went straight out of the galaxy. If you were near the center of the galaxy, you probably were in bad shape back then, but we're pretty safe. But that doesn't mean you still wouldn't see something. So we could have seen a huge glow in the direction of the center of the galaxy. So that could have been pretty amazing. And the fact that this could potentially happen again, if, you know, that's something that we really have to consider. I mean, just think of this past year. We saw Sagittarius A star increase in brightness by a factor of 75 in near infrared wavelengths. That's the brightest we've ever seen our black hole in that wavelength. So who knows, you know, what's going to happen in the future with our black hole. But no matter what happens, we're safe. Don't even get anxious over that. But even if it doesn't happen, there could still be important ramifications in terms of our theories of galaxy evolution. For example, Magna Guglielmo, who's an astronomer at the University of Sydney, said these results dramatically change our understanding of the Milky Way. We always thought about our galaxy as an inactive galaxy with a not-so-bright center. These new results instead open the possibility of a complete reinterpretation of its evolution and nature. So, wow. So, keep an eye on this one. Who knows what will change in the near future about how we think the Milky Way evolved and maybe how it will evolve in the future based on these findings. Cool stuff.
Yeah, cool. All right, Kara, so have they found Amelia Earhart's plane yet or what?
No.
It's late.
Story over.
It's way late.
They thought they might be about to.
Okay.
Cool story, bro. No, okay, so we'll talk a little bit about what did happen. Have we heard of Bob Ballard? You guys know him, like
yes,
his name?
Yes, the Titanic.
Yes, there you go. He's the guy who found the Titanic. He's apparently very good at what he does. And, you know, people put a lot of stock into his decisions. And for decades, he didn't really want to chase Amelia Earhart because he felt like the evidence just wasn't strong. And it would be like a goose chase. The area where the wreckage could potentially be was spread way too wide. There wasn't enough evidence to help kind of home in on something that was feasible. But some new evidence came in recently. I think, honestly, he was just convinced by a handful of people that there was a new site that was pretty worth searching. So let's talk about that, what they did find, what they didn't find, and kind of where we are now. Okay, so Niku Maroro, which is an atoll that's part of the Phoenix Islands in the South Pacific. So basically out in the middle of the ocean, there is this atoll, like I said, that's surrounded by coral reefs. And there was a theory that came out, and you guys might have talked about this on the show before. How many times have you talked about like Amelia Earhart conspiracy theories and stuff?
Just a couple times, but we have talked about it.
So this is not in the really conspiracy side of things. This is in the, well, we're grasping at straws, but at least there's something here, so maybe we should talk about it. So apparently there's a photo. Have you spoken about the Bevington image? It's a photo that was taken in the area by a British officer in 1940. And I think it was actually, I can't remember who had it, like the State Department or some government agency had it. Obama's State Department, an official in that State Department, had access to this image. He asked to have it enhanced, probably because he was pretty interested in Amelia Earhart. And it ended up being pretty blurry, but there was an object in this image that could be consistent with the landing gear of Earhart's plane. You know, she famously flew, what was it called? An Electra, a Model 10 Electra by Lockheed. And it was like the same size, shape, whatever, when they looked at the image. So it was like, okay, this is interesting. And it's not really a shot in the dark because they were able over several years to triangulate her distress calls. And her distress calls from, I think, three different sites. There was a site like in Hawaii and a couple of other sites where when they received those distress calls, they were able to triangulate them to an area in the South Pacific that included Niku Maroro. So then this photo surfaces. It's an old photo. You know, it's kind of grainy. And they're like, that kind of combined with the fact that there was a distress call somewhere around there. Okay, maybe this is where the wreck is. Maybe we should at least go check. And so that's what Bob Ballard did aboard the Nautilus with a massive team and, you know, Nat Geo photographers. Apparently there is a group called the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery. And so they're really interested in these old crashes and kind of collect as much evidence as they can. And people within this group, this nonprofit, have also been really interested in this specific Niku Maroro theory. So Ballard decided to go. They, you know, based on the shape of the island and the way that the reefs go and the ridges go, they were able to kind of figure out exactly where they should search. Didn't find anything. Went a little bit deeper, didn't find anything. Went a little bit farther out, didn't find anything. I think they found like some hats and some cans, which is crazy because it's an uninhabited island. But they didn't find any pieces of her plane. Now, you know, some researchers have said this plane would be reduced to nothing. It was, you know, aluminum. So it would have broken down smaller and smaller and smaller and probably is now strewn all over the Pacific or grown over by coral. Like some people said, you're never going to find anything. But other people have actually said that I think there's two portions of the plane. Anyway, there are two portions of these specific planes that are apparently like built like a brick house, like actually more than a brick house, that a lot of researchers are saying likely wouldn't have broken down into teeny tiny bits over even all this time. So there probably is wreckage somewhere. Okay, so they haven't found any parts of her plane here on this island. Bob Ballard, you know, is cited as saying, like, that doesn't mean this was all for naught. We know that this plane existed. This isn't like the Loch Ness Monster, right? She actually existed. She flew a plane and it crashed and no one has been able to find it. So now we have new evidence. It might be negative evidence, but at least now we know it's not here. So, okay, it's not a complete waste of time. And, you know, maybe it is, I guess the next stop on her trip was something like Howard. I think Howard Island is what it's called. And they think that that's, or they know that that's where she was planning to refuel. So somewhere between, oh, Howland, I'm so sorry. Howland is where she was planning to refuel. They know there were distress calls somewhere around here. They know that she was going to refuel at Howland. Maybe, you know, her wreckage is there. And in 2021, apparently this same research vessel, the Nautilus, is actually going to be near there anyway for another contract. And so they're going to take a quick trip, Ballard and his crew. But in the meantime, there's another kind of interesting wrinkle to this story. Since the 80s, TIGHAR, the nonprofit that's interested in crashed planes, has conducted 12 different expeditions to Niku Maroro because it's well known that there were skeletal remains there. In 1940, the same time, I think around the same time when that photograph was taken, 13 bones were gathered from like a makeshift bivouac, so like a campsite on this island, Nikumaroro. And at the time in 1940, a doctor in Fiji analyzed the bones and said, I think that these belong to a European man. Then the bones went missing. A few decades later, this Tighar group was actually able, not, they couldn't find the bones. Nobody had been able to find the bones, but they found the doctor's notes and they sent it to a modern forensic anthropologist. And that modern forensic anthropologist at the University of Tennessee, he was like the emeritus director of the whole outfit there. He looked at them and published a study that basically said that these bones were more similar to Earhart than a man. Something like, I think the quote is, more similar to the Earhart's build was more similar to the Nikumaroro bones than 99% of individuals in a large reference sample. So then Tighar goes back. They start looking for more skeletons. They haven't really been able to find bones or DNA, but they found some like items from this like campsite. This new expedition has decided to actually collect soil from the campsite and see if they can use more modern techniques to find mitochondrial DNA. And they're going to compare those soil samples to Earhart's living relatives. Because if they can show that she was there at all, that might be an interesting piece of the puzzle being put together. And then the most recent twist is that some individuals were visiting the National Museum in Tarawa, which is the capital of Kiribati, which is the chain of islands, Kiribati, where Nikumaroro is found. And they saw pieces of a female skull on a shelf, and it's completely unmarked and nobody knows who it is or where it came from. So they're going to analyze the DNA of that skull. So we're waiting on the DNA analysis. If any of it seems to be related to Earhart, then really interesting. They're probably like on the right path. If it doesn't, then they know that this was not the hypothesis that that bore fruit. Maybe there will be better evidence pointing to somewhere else later. Maybe there won't. But either way, I think Ballard and his team felt like it was compelling enough, and it was kind of the only real good evidence, lines of maybe circumstantial evidence that we had, so it was worth following up on. I'm definitely interested to see how the docu comes out and like what they actually mentioned. Maybe they're withholding some information and there's more in that, or maybe this is it, but I don't know. It's, you know, another, I guess, chapter in the story, but the story is definitely not closed.
I don't think it's ever going to close.
But, you know, the ocean is very big.
I mean, they gave up looking for a modern airliner, you know?
Mm-hmm, exactly. But get this, and I didn't realize this, Ballard reminded his team when they were starting to get kind of tired, right? Like looking for the wreckage for Amelia Earhart, and they were like, this is never going to happen, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, you know, don't forget, it took us 5 different expeditions to find the Titanic.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And they knew roughly Ballard's, the vicinity where the Titanic had gone down.
And this is only Ballard's first expedition to try and look for Earhart. I mean, he's a much older man, but he also has a lot of backing now, right? And a lot of people are really excited. Oh, the one thing I forgot is that turns out when they were in the area exactly where the photo, the Bevington photo, was taken, they realized there are so many rocks on the beach that look exactly like the landing gear in the picture that they started calling the rocks landing gear rocks. They're like, yeah, there's another landing gear rock.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, blurry photos. I mean, it's like blob squatch. Never going to be definitive.
Blob squatch. Yeah.
Every time I hear it, I want to make a T-shirt that's blob squatch.
Yeah, yeah.
But they did say, you know, one of the researchers on the ship, Fundus, she was saying we felt like if her plane was there, we would have found it really early in the expedition. But that's when Dr. Ballard was like, "Don't forget, it took." Oh, I'm sorry, I said 5. I meant 4. I didn't mean it. I'm just changing my answer. It took 4 expeditions to find the Titanic, and in one of those they missed the ship by under 500 feet.
Yeah, it was right there.
Wow.
And it's a big ship. It was broken in 2, but still it was,
yeah, it's a big ship with a lot of debris. So that's the thing, this stuff isn't easy. I mean, this thing could be very deep at this point. It could be buried. It could be broken into a gajillion little pieces. So yeah, it's tough.
Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, very important noisy this week. Just kidding. last week I played this noisy.
I know what that is.
Yeah, lots of stuff going on in there. So first off, anybody got any ideas?
Yes.
No.
In the game Plants vs. Zombies, one of the zombies comes into the screen driving a Zamboni. And it makes this startup engine noise. You can hear it coming, so you can prepare, you know, to attack or put more plants in that road and knock that thing right out. And that's the exact noise that it makes. So it's the Zamboni from Plants vs. Zombies. Thank you.
You know, Evan, you might be on to something.
That's awesome.
Wow.
Yep.
Okay,
anybody
that's
else?
Surprising.
Nope.
Okay, so a listener named Bapizer, B-A-P-E-R-R-I-Z-O, Bapizero, Bapizero. He says, hey, Jay, today's noisy sounds like one engine being used to prime another. Maybe a diesel generator starting a high-speed jet engine like was used on the SR-71 Blackbird. Ooh. I've never heard anything like that firsthand, just a shot in the dark. That is incorrect, but not completely wrong. Just, you know, you didn't guess correctly, but you got a little bit of something in there, just like with Evan. Mm-hmm. Another listener named Eric Rothwell said, hi, Jay, being an old farm boy, I think I hear a familiar sound with today's Who's That Noisy. I'm pretty sure we are listening to an old diesel tractor starting up through the use of a smaller gasoline-powered pony motor. That is also incorrect. But not a bad guess. I did not know that big tractors used a pony motor to start them. I got another guess from Brian Pavo, and Brian says, the noisy sounds suspiciously like the noise of the other side of my office wall every day, a Robinson R-44 aircraft starting up, typically 121 decibels at 5 meters, but without the piston sounds.
Time to move your office.
I know, right? I suspect it's one of the experimental electric conversions out there. That's pretty cool. That's a little bit closer to the correct answer. Okay, so let's get right to the winner. The winner is Kev Cook, and Kev said, hi, Jay, new listener. I believe that the sound of this week's Who's That Noisy is the engine startup of a Robinson R-22 helicopter. Okay, now, it is not the R-22 helicopter, but it is a helicopter starting up, and it's a remarkably similar helicopter.
The R-21?
Well, no, they're similarly sized. The exterior is very similar. The actual answer, and this was sent in by Mark McConnell. Mark sent in a recording. This is him taking a recording at work. He said this is a Cabri G2 helicopter starting up. And this was a recording taken from inside the cockpit. So I did give Kev Cook that as the win, even though they didn't hit it right on the head, just because it was super difficult to guess the exact make and model and everything. But so here's what you're hearing. First, you hear the tone that alerts you that the plasma ignition system is on. Then the starter is engaged and you hear it turning the engine over. When the engine fires and the starter is released, the sound of the engine idling can be heard. This is quickly followed by three clicks that are the alternator, fuel pump, and clutch switches being thrown. Shortly after that, the clutch begins to engage and that produces the squealing noise as the belt slips again, the drive shaft wheel. The clutch mechanism works by using engine oil pressure to extend a piston that rotates the engine downward out of its mounting. This increases the distance between the engine output shaft and the drive shaft and tightens the belt. Once the clutch is fully engaged, the squealing stops and you can hear the engine note rise as the RPM is increased. You can also hear the swishing of the rotors turning overhead. So, a very complicated engine starting up. But I thought that was a really cool sound. I've never actually heard a helicopter start up from scratch like that for real, because the movies, you know, you never know if you're hearing the right thing in the movies. Like, for example, whenever you hear an eagle cry in a movie or scream, it's not an eagle.
Right.
It's not an eagle.
Fox?
Yeah, it's a hawk.
A hawk. Yeah. I mean, I said fox. I meant hawk. Obviously, I meant hawk.
So anyway, that was a fun noisy. Thank you very much for that one, Mark. And thank you for all the fun answers and guesses that came in. I have a new noisy this week. This one is themed, and this one is for Bob.
Ooh, for you, Bob.
This is a noisy from a listener named Adam Hepburn and his daughter, Olivia. You can hear Olivia breathing in there.
Jeez.
Talk about a horror movie.
Yeah,
yes,
something
totally.
Out of The Shining.
Yeah, I like it. Like
so my question is, what made that noise? So I took this week's new noisy and I enhanced it for Bob because, you know, it's Halloween. Here we go.
Yeah.
That's for you, Bob.
Awesome, Jay.
Couple of things to announce. We have formally launched the skepticsguide.org/T3 or the alphaquadrant6.com/T3 phaser giveaway, the Star Trek phaser giveaway. And we did mention this on the show last week. The pages are up. You can enter the contest by going to alphaquadrant6.com/T3 or theskepticsguide.org/T3. You can join the contest by doing one of several things. One is you could just become a patron of the SGU or of Alpha Quadrant 6. If you're already a patron, you're already entered. You can enter without becoming a patron by giving us your email address. And if you want to get more entries, you could give us a short answer of why you think you should win the phaser.
Ooh.
Yeah. And it'll be fun because I've read a few of the entries already. I just read a few of them today. And it's fun. You know, people are trying to be creative and do something funny or whatever. It could be legit. It could be funny. Just write us whatever hits your head. And we will be judging the absolute best answer. And that will give you more entries, right? So you could basically collect a number of entries by doing one or more of these things.
Hey, Jay.
Yeah.
I'm going to regret this.
Do it.
What is the difference
between a blaster? Yes, blaster and a phaser. All right, so that's a very good question. Now,
okay.
blasters typically shoot some form of plasma. Mm-hmm. And they also say that some blasters might even have something solid that they're shooting. But typically, they're both energy weapons. A plasma, it's not a plasma beam. It's more of like when you see a
it's
shot.
Like a ball of plasma, yeah.
It's a ball of plasma, or a bolt of plasma is more
projectile.
Like it.
Projectile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, a good, a well-placed plasma hit will kill most people or aliens. Mm-hmm. Now, mm-hmm. a phaser is a very complicated thing because it's using phased, quote-unquote, phased light, right, Bob?
It's a phased laser.
It's a phased laser.
But it's also like these hypothetical particles, like was it anions that they emit? It's kind of weird.
Anions are really? Real things.
Wait, I may be confusing that with real science. Hang on a second, kid.
Yeah.
Oh, gee, don't do that. Well, while Bob's trying to figure that out, the main thing about a phaser is that you could shoot a phaser like a stream of water, like it just beam and it's on.
It's a
you know,
beam,
and
yeah.
then it's a beam.
Hence
and
you laser, do, right?
Yep. Where when you shoot a blaster, it's like ching, and it shoots a blaster bolt, and it's a one shot.
Or does it go pew,
no
pew pew pew? Which one makes that noise?
Blasters?
Wait, no, this is the blaster. That's a blaster.
Wait, are there any semi-automatic blasters?
Yes,
sure, absolutely, there are.
Yeah, there are.
On vehicles, they're usually mounted.
You know, in Rogue One, they had the
in
guy
Rogue
had
One.
A,
yeah,
he had an energy
so they
backpack.
Just go like, pew 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 pew.
Oh, his okay. was yeah, his was faster. Go ahead, Bob.
Okay, so phasers emit a beam of subatomic particles called rapid nadions. NADIONS.
Yeah, that's not a real thing.
Right.
It is now.
Now this whole thing, this whole contest is tied to us reaching our 4,000 patron goal for the SGU. Mm-hmm. Because as you know, and I've said this many times, when we hit 4,000 patrons, we're going to have a 12-hour live stream celebration as a thank you back to all of our listeners. We're going to, you know, we don't need to get into the details of what that is because we've talked about it quite a bit, but that is going to happen. And when we hit 4,000, mm-hmm. we will be giving this phaser rifle away to the lucky mm-hmm. winner that we will pick through the hidden and very secret process behind the scenes.
Yeah, that's
random.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
We're going to have to do math in order to figure out how many entries each person has. Then I'll make the spreadsheet.
But that's still random. It's random based on entries, not random based on people.
That's
correct. Random based on entries. Yes. Exactly.
But if you write a good description on why you deserve the phaser or why you need the phaser, I will be giving you more entries depending on the quality of that writing that you do. Yes, yes.
Mm. Number
so really,
of chits in the bowl kind of thing.
Yeah. So, you know, please do. If you don't currently support the SGU or Alpha Quadrant 6, then if you're interested in either of those two shows, you know, please consider becoming a patron because you help us continue to do the work that we do and expand the work that we're doing.
Yeah, listen, we've really been anxious to get to 4,000 patrons because we're going to do the 12-hour show. And just the thought of me torturing all of my fellow rogues for 12 hours straight is, you know, I dream about it at night.
Bring it on.
It's going to be
that's why you dream
it's going to it's going to be amazing. It's going to be amazing. And we'll give away the phaser rifle. Maybe we'll give it away live during the 12-hour show. So we really need your help to get us there. I know we have a lot of longtime listeners who support the SGU who just haven't gotten around to doing it. Well, just we really would appreciate any support that you give us because it helps us do all the stuff that we do to try to change the world to make it more skeptical.
And if you don't know about our science fiction review show, it's called Alpha Quadrant 6, and you can go to the website and check it out. It is a YouTube show, and I've just now converted it to a podcast as well. So there's two episodes up. By the time you hear this, there probably will be a third episode up, and I will be converting all of our past episodes into podcasts over the coming, you know, 6 months or so. You know, I'm going to probably be adding an extra one in every week. So guys, thank you very much. I think the 12-hour show, as Steve says, you know, it's already torturous just thinking about the fact that because just like the freaking trip to Australia, New Zealand, it is so much prep work. How can you do this to me, Steve?
It's easy.
Can't we just go in cold and sit there and just be like, yeah, 12 hours. No, Steve makes us prep. We have so much prep work for these freaking shows.
But it's worth it.
And we only get to a fraction of the material.
I know. Could you imagine?
Over-prep.
When we did the 24-hour show, I was like, how are we going to do it? We didn't get to a quarter of the stuff that we made. Like, we made so much stuff. And then when we did, now, what was the last one we did?
The 10-hour.
That flew by so fast, I couldn't believe it. But still, we have to prep like we're not going to have any spontaneous discussions. You know, like we need to prepare content because we just can't sit there and, you know,
can't riff for 12 hours. We got to have content. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey guys, when this podcast is uploaded Saturday, my haunt will be on its second night of four nights. So if you're local to the Danbury area, you want to check out my charity haunt that me and my friends put together. It's awesome. It's in Danbury, Connecticut. Go to forestoffear.org for all the details. If you like haunted houses, this will be very creepy.
Forest of Fear.
Forestoffear.org.
All right, thanks, Bob. So we're going to do one email, though it's actually more than one email. We're going to do one email topic. We had a lot of feedback on the recent discussion we had about the health effects of eating meat. A lot of people wrote in to express similar points. And so rather than reading through any specific emails, I'm just going to address the points that were raised. I think the biggest feedback that we had was people complaining about the fact that we didn't talk about the environmental effects of eating meat.
But that's not what the study
was. But that wasn't what the study was about. Right. So that was deliberate. We were focusing on the study. And in fact, the study authors wrote in the study, we are explicitly not considering either ethical considerations, you know, of animal welfare or environmental considerations. We are 100% considering only the health effects of eating meat. And that's the literature they reviewed. I mentioned that in my science-based medicine article on it. I don't think I mentioned it specifically in the show, but the study was about the health effects. That's all we were talking about. And we just, listen, the show's long enough as it is. We can't talk about every aspect of every topic that comes up. And sometimes we specifically have to keep focused, but also we've talked about the environmental effects of eating meat in previous shows. I do consider this show, I mean, while each topic and each episode is a thing unto itself, the show is also cumulative. We're expecting that people are going to be listening to, you know, more than just that one segment in isolation. We've talked many times about the fact that, you know, eating meat is definitely a huge burden on the environment, and it uses up a lot of water. It uses up a lot of land for producing food for animals. And although I don't think that it's as simple an issue as I think some of the emailers suggested, one of the studies that we reviewed not too long ago made the point that, yeah, we, you know, especially industrialized nations, you know, we're eating about twice as much meat as we were eating 50 years ago. It's by pretty much any account, it's too much in terms of environmental sustainability. But they didn't say that we necessarily have to 100% eliminate all meat. In fact, we're better off using each parcel of land for whatever purpose it's optimized for, and which could be doing nothing with it, you know, leaving it fallow. It could be growing a certain specific kind of crop. It could be grazing. So I do think that we should reduce our meat consumption on average for environmental concerns, but that just wasn't the topic that we were talking about last week. Some people, you know, this is now sort of a bigger observation about if you're going to send us email, and we love all the feedback that we get. We are definitely open to any corrections, any criticism, any observations. You know, we want to hear your feedback. I read it all. I incorporate it all into shaping the show. But I'm going to give you some advice on what not to do, right? It's not helpful when your email is focusing on your perception of our biases. This is just not good critical thinking or skeptical communication. If you're saying you guys are clearly biased, you know, this is your blind spot, that you're true believers, whatever, that's, you're not making any legitimate points there. That you're playing a version of the fallacy, you know? It's just not effective. Believe me, been doing this for decades. I used to do a lot more of that 20 years ago when I was, you know, a newbie skeptic. And then over the years, I realized that's like the most ineffective way of communicating. It's just to tell other people that they're biased or that they have blind spots or whatever. Even if you think it's true, it just doesn't get you anywhere.
Also, if there's a lot of like anger in the tone of the email, it makes it much harder, I think, don't you think? To get through and not think that it's like a passionate plea instead of a kind of a conversation.
Right. I mean, one person, I mean, was telling me that I need to consider my cognitive dissonance. Mm-hmm. When,
yes, yeah. Steve, it's not like you wrote a book
but
about
the
it.
Thing that's ironic was the cognitive dissonance in their email was blaring, which I didn't say. Okay, but that's my opinion of their email. But the point is, it's like that doesn't progress the conversation at all. And then I even wrote back and said, all right, listen, do you have any specific criticism of my actual analysis of the study? And their response to that was, well, essentially, no, I'm not an expert. I didn't read the study. I have no idea what the quality of your analysis was. It's like, well, that's right. That's all you have to say at that point, right? Because the whole point was that not a single email with all of the feedback that we got actually was able to point out any legitimate criticism of the methodology in the study or my assessment of it or my characterization of what the study was concluded. I was completely fair, in my opinion, and nobody was able to point out otherwise.
Well, it sounds like it's less about the study. And some people are more upset about what did you choose to cover? Not so much like how well did you cover it?
No, but they did. You're right. That was mm-hmm. really what got them upset. But they made the point, like, you weren't skeptical in your evaluation of that study. Really?
Oh, that's a bummer.
Tell me how I wasn't skeptical. Please, give me detailed technical feedback and I will incorporate that. And if there's a correction, we'll make it. But there was just a broad brushstroke dismissal. You know,
and it is. It's also super difficult when we're talking about big issues, right? Like meat eating is massive. It has an environmental side of it. It has an ethical side of it. It has a functional side of it, an economic side of it. And so, as much as we try really hard to contextualize everything in the greater milieu, there are just going to be times when, like, it would take 40 minutes just to give the
we have to focus. Prep. In this show, we talked about the nuclear energy thing. Of course, we didn't do a thorough treatment of that very complicated topic. And there are probably things you think are important that we didn't talk about. You know,
I wish we could.
It's an hour and a half show. It's not a 10-hour show.
And you'd be bored listening to that, I think.
Yes, we would.
Can I give you my perspective a little bit on this? You know, keeping in mind, we're all human beings and we all are very passionate about certain things. We have buttons, right? I've got a lot of them.
That's true.
And that's what I was seeing a lot of people like responding from what my interpretation was, that their buttons were being pushed. Like there was something about our reporting on it that really was upsetting them. And I bet you, Steve, that it really wasn't like the way that we did it or the way that you delivered the information so much as
the thing that gets under their skin wasn't being addressed in the level of intensity that they want.
Yeah.
I get it. It's kind of like, I think it's two things. It's like, you're not talking about what I want you to be talking about.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that, and I think this is something where people have to look inward. It's when you're passionate about a topic, you want all of the points to be on your side, right? So let's say you are passionately against meat because of its environmental impact or because of animal welfare. Mm-hmm. You want to also it be bad for your health, you know?
Yeah.
And the idea that like you have this nuanced position where it's like, all right, maybe it's not bad for your health, but it's still bad for the environment. Some people just really hate doing that. Mm-hmm. And as a knee jerk, and we have to always back up and say every point doesn't have to be in one direction, in the direction that I am most passionate about, right? There could be it could be mixed, it could be more nuanced. So just right, and I think that's going on as well. All right, but here one a few emailers did bring up an important point that came out after we talked about it. So this is something that we didn't talk about because it didn't come out yet. There are two points were raised about failure to disclose potential conflicts of interest on the part of one of the authors.
Okay.
But here's the thing. First of all, technically, they followed the rules. They were supposed to disclose any potential conflicts of interest from the last 3 years. And the things that people are pointing about were from prior to 3 years ago. Although, here's the one which you could argue falls a little bit into the gray zone. They received the money for a study more than 3 years ago, but the study itself didn't end up getting published to just within the 3 year, you know, range.
Because it takes a really long time.
Yeah, but whatever. They figured, well, I got that money 4 years ago, so I didn't report it. But you could always argue that you should have erred on the side of disclosure. Fine. Okay.
Absolutely.
But that's such a minor point. But the other thing is this was not money from the meat industry. They weren't disclosing money from like the sugar industry, you know, on a previous study that they did. So it was just from the food industry. It wasn't really, but then the second one was from the meat industry, but again, it was outside the window, but also it was like two steps removed. It was that this group was now not on this study, but on a different project are collaborating with a university group who received like a 2% of their income comes from the meat industry because they're in agriculture.
Yeah, which is really
and so the thing is,
this is super tenuous. Similar to I know, a lot. Yeah. I mean, not some tenuous. Of the things, but some of the other things that you know we've talked about on the show with regards to people like Kevin Folter, anybody who studies GM. You know, who does GM research is likely to be funded by companies that are interested in GM technology because they work for ag schools.
Now, the headlines were all, you know, author of that controversial meat study did not disclose food industry conflicts of interest, right? That was it. If you just read the headline, you think, well, there you go. The guy's, you know, is a shill.
Yeah.
But first of all, it was one of like 14 authors we're talking about. And the second thing was these are tenuous connections that were technically outside the window. And
but I do wish he would have disclosed.
Of course. Yeah, but the thing is, nothing would have made them happy, in my opinion. This is using conflict of interest disclosure into a witch hunt, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And when you're basically looking for any tenuous connection and then saying that disqualifies this study when it wasn't like this study was not funded by the meat industry. There was no direct conflict of interest. They were not acting as shills. They really had to go pretty far afield to try to draw some tenuous connection. Again, it was like two steps removed. And the thing is, if you're a researcher in any field, you have two-step, removed connections to some potential conflict of interest.
Oh, for sure.
100%. And I'm sensitive to this because this happens to us. When I say us, I mean us at Science-Based Medicine, where people will say, your colleague at your university received funding from this company, and therefore, I mean, like this ridiculous chain of connections. Like, congratulations. I'm in academia. Right. But now, having said that, though, you absolutely should disclose funding and connections and potential conflicts of interest so people can make up their own minds. Absolutely.
Exactly.
The thing is,
papers have those.
Yeah, that's right.
But a lot of
that's
them
fine.
Do. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
But you have to put them in context. And the thing is, they were just hunting for any tenuous connection so that they could dismiss the study, in my opinion. And these connections are not really conflicts of interest. They don't really call into question the objectivity of the authors on this review, in my opinion. But they were kind of used flippantly to just dismiss it. And other people were saying, oh, this goes against decades of research. No, it doesn't. As I explained. They're summarizing those exact decades of research, the same research. They're just putting a different interpretation on it. And they were pretty transparent about how that they were interpreting it, as I discussed. I'm not going to go over it all again, as I discussed a couple of weeks ago. But anyway, so just think carefully about those things, you know, especially if you feel passionate or emotionally about a topic. Just, you know, think very carefully about where you're coming from. Give us feedback, but do try to just, this is good skeptical training anyway, try to focus on facts and logic rather than you speculating about the motivations of the person you disagree with, because that doesn't get you anywhere. So let's go on now with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items, two real and one fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. All right, we got three regular news items. Are you guys ready?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yep.
No theme. Here we go. Number one, biologists have successfully grown an artificial pancreas from stem cells and demonstrated function in a rat model. Item number two, scientists have found a neural circuit that makes food taste better with increased hunger. And item number three, researchers find that strong storms can generate stormquakes similar to earthquakes of magnitude greater than 3.5. So to clarify, that means they will be recorded on a seismographer as an earthquake, you know, at that at a greater magnitude than 3.5. Strong storms, you know, we're talking like hurricanes. Bob, go first.
Okay, artificial pancreas. In a rat model, God, I want this to be true so badly. We really need a huge win for stem cells and artificial organs. Oh, man, I haven't seen anything about it. Let's see. Neural circuit that makes food taste better with increased hunger. Scientists have found. Yeah, man, that's a thing. I mean, it's such a thing. Like, it's the best crackers I ever had. remember? Eddie Murphy?
Yeah.
In the desert, starving, and gets crackers. Like, these are the best crackers ever. Yeah, that's a neural circuit. It makes sense, I guess. Let's try three. Wow. I don't know. Strong storm. Stormquakes. I don't know, man. I might have to pull the card of like, I would have heard of this. I mean, geez, it's greater than 3.5. Shaking the ground. Nah, there's no epicenter under the ground. It's gonna shake the ground. Nah. Screw it. I'm going to say that's baloney. Fiction. Strong storm surges or stormquakes. Fiction.
Okay, Evan.
An artificial pancreas from stem cells, huh? Now, the pancreas creates insulin in the body? Am I right recalling that correctly?
That's correct.
Okay.
I'll give that to you.
And demonstrated function in a rat model, an artificial pancreas. Well, that's pretty remarkable, if it's true.
Remarkable.
And then this neural circuit making food taste better with increased hunger. I can see that being the case, and they've located this neural circuit. I don't have a problem with that one. Bob, your point about the stormquakes, you know, you would have heard of it, maybe. But similar to earthquakes, magnitude 3.5. Now, 3.5 is significant, but...
Yeah.
It is. I would think it. It sounds significant to me.
That's about the magnitude of that quake that hit Virginia like 7 or 8 years ago when I was there.
Oh, the toilet. Yeah. The toilet quake.
The toilet quake, yeah.
Toilet quake episode. I do
remember
that. The
great toilet quake of 2016.
Well, boy, some of these storms, you know, can be very, very strong. We just recently experienced an extremely strong one in the Atlantic not long ago, just a month or two ago. Well, as much as I would like to think that this artificial pancreas one is true, I have a feeling that this one is the fiction. I think it wasn't derived from stem cells. They're working on something else. Brass ring, you know, it's too far along. They're on the road to it, but they're not there yet.
Okay, Kara.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like as I've been looking through these, I'm leaning towards agreeing with Evan. And I think the reason for that is that the two that seem like off the page obvious. Oh, yeah, totally. They could grow an artificial pancreas from stem cells. Or, oh, yeah, totally. There's a neural circuit that makes food taste better with increased hunger. And then the Stormquakes one is like, what? That's impossible. Which makes me think that, A, the Stormquakes one is true, is science. And one of the other two are fiction. It's very hard for me to believe that there's not some functional brain activity that does make food taste better. That would have a fully adaptive function, right? The hungrier you get, the more you're willing to eat things that are unappetizing, and that's going to save your life potentially. I like that one, but the artificial pancreas one sticks out to me because I'm like, if it was that easy, they would have done it already. This is such an obvious thing that everybody's trying to figure out. And I think that if it had happened, we'd be celebrating it a little bit more. I don't know.
Okay, so the pancreas one is fiction?
Yep.
Okay, and Jay?
In reverse order, the Stormquakes. The only thing that I would question there is if that is the actual magnitude. You know, I'd like to know the mechanism, but I don't think it would be impossible for a massive storm. Like, think about the power of a hurricane to have some effect on the land. So that one is fine. Scientists, the neural circuit thing to make food taste better. Sure. Like everything Kara said, I completely agree with. Yes, increase hunger. To food that you normally wouldn't be wanting to eat. You know, if you're hungrier, you're going to eat weirder stuff until you literally get down to shoe leather. Seriously. So that one is absolutely science. So I do agree with Kara that this one about the pancreas is a no, just because, you know, it's one thing if they coerce some stem cells to act like other kinds of cells. We do that all the time. It's another thing to create an entire organ that functions as an organ, which is a collection of cells that do a certain collection of processes. So, I think that one's a fake.
All right. So you all agree on number two. So we'll start there. Scientists have found a neural circuit that makes food taste better with increased hunger. You all think this one makes perfect sense. Of course there's a circuit in the brain does this. Why wouldn't there be?
Right.
And this one is... science.
Oh, they did find it.
Yeah, it does make absolutely adaptive sense. And but they found the circuit. This was in a mouse, not in a human. That's why I just said I didn't make it sound like it was people.
It's people.
It's people. So it's there's a circuit that connects to the hypothalamus. And what they found was that it actually makes sweet things taste sweeter. Mm. And bitter and sour things taste less bitter and sour. They responded less to those stimuli. So you would be attracted more to high-calorie food, and you would be repulsed less by bitterness and sourness.
Nice. Let's activate this 24/7.
Why?
Artificially stimulated?
We'd be obese. I'll be obese.
Everything will taste awesome.
But if they did tap into this for people who struggle, you know, but people who are intrinsically aversive to eating vegetables, you know, we talked about the super picky people.
Sure.
Yeah.
This could be helpful. It could be like a medical treatment for them so that they can, you know, eat a bigger range of food and get the nutrition they need.
I don't know. I wouldn't mess with the hypothalamus, man. It's going to cause obesity.
Well, I'm just wondering if there's like a drug or something they could tap into. I don't know. Eventually.
But I'm always reminded of the book The Stand, which is a great book.
Stephen King.
There's a scene where one of the bad guys is locked in a jail cell when the world goes to crap, and he's stuck there.
He gets recruited by the devil.
Yeah, and like one
I'd sign up.
Cage over, there's a dead rat, and he's looking at it as it's decaying the whole time. And it's like, when is he going to get to the threshold where he's going to eat that dead rat, you know? And of course he does.
Sure.
But that scene always sticks with me. And I have occasionally wondered, like, if I were starving, how far down that would I go? Yeah. Like, what could I be compelled to eat if I were starving to death? Mm-hmm. You know?
Well, I would think I don't think you're going to eat a sofa, right? But if there's anything remotely food-like, you know, anything that has even the semblance of food, like, because again, people actually ate shoe leather.
I know,
like on ships and stuff. Oh, Also, in terms of medical treatments, maybe this could help. I mean, it's probably more purely psychological, but maybe there is a neurological deficit in people who, you've seen shows like My Strange Addiction.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Like people with pica, like people yeah. who like to eat things that are non-nutritive. So that could be interesting. Maybe there's some, you know, potential downstream benefit to this research, like mm-hmm. actual functional benefit.
Oh, yeah. Practical. Yeah, there probably yeah. will be. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to number one. Biologists have successfully grown an artificial pancreas from stem cells and demonstrated function in a rat model. Jay, Kara, and Evan think this one is the fiction. Bob, you think this one is science. And I'm this screwed. One is... The fiction.
Fiction.
Yay.
Good job, guys.
Sadly.
Evan, you came the closest. You pretty much nailed it. They did develop an artificial pancreas. This is one where I'm hoping you're going to read the headline and not read the body.
Didn't see it at all.
But the quote-unquote artificial pancreas is technological. It's not stem cells.
Yeah.
It's biological. Mm. And what they're using that term, artificial pancreas, as a way to refer to a closed loop system that will measure blood sugar and secrete insulin based upon the blood sugar level, right? So this has been one
so
of the
people don't have to wake up in the middle of
yeah,
the night.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. They don't have to inject themselves. So you have an insulin pump and a continuous blood glucose monitor. And those two things hook together with a computer that can read the blood glucose and then secrete the appropriate amount of insulin. So this has been one of the holy grails, you know, of medicine for a while now, closing the loop. There's not that many steps involved. What's the blood sugar level? And here's the insulin. You know what I mean? So it's totally feasible. I also think that, you know, and the reason why I made this the fiction that I did is that a pancreas is probably one of the low-hanging fruit in terms of like a stem cell organ, because it could just be a clump of tissue that just has the right, you know, that just senses glucose and releases insulin. You know what I mean? Doesn't need a lot of complicated connectivity just for that part of the function. The pancreas does other stuff as well, but
really?
You know, there are some times when just transplanting a clump of tissue into the body could have effects. We've already done it. I mean, it already exists.
Yeah, I would think livers, too, would be low-hanging fruit because they have that potential, right? They're like homogeneous livers.
Well, livers have structure to them. That's a little bit more complicated. But yeah, you might be able to do some kind of biochemical functionality with the liver that without too much structure.
Kidneys, it's not like trying to build a
really
kidney.
Really tough. Yeah, kidney, yeah, really exactly. complicated structure. The brain, obviously, is the most complicated. Heart is also pretty low-hanging fruit because heart muscle cells will spontaneously synchronize with other cells. So they kind of self-organize. So that might think will be one of the easier ones to do.
People have been getting heart, you know, transplanted hearts, portions of their hearts from cadavers or from other animals. They've been getting pacemakers. Like there are a lot of implants around the heart. So I feel like in terms of the medical feasibility of working in this organ, we know more about kind of what we can and can't do. What are the limits of the body with the heart?
Yeah,
whereas
absolutely.
Pancreas is like you get pancreatic cancer, you're screwed. Like there, it like it's hard to mess with the pancreas, right? It's like it's a very sensitive.
Yeah, it's, I think pancreatic cancer is bad because of where it is. I think it's like right in the middle of all the organs. You know, it's like it's touching a lot of other things. It's very easy for it to metastasize. It also feels self-contained.
Screwing with your pancreas means that you're messing with an organ that's in the middle of all your other organs.
Yeah.
You know, it's like sometimes it really is just about the physical anatomy.
Sometimes, yeah. I think so. All right. Yeah. So let's go on to number three. Researchers find that strong storms can generate stormquakes similar to earthquakes of magnitude greater than 3.5. This one, of course, is Science. The name of the paper published in Geophysical Research Letters is... Stormquakes.
There you go.
So how do you think this works?
No idea.
Yeah, so you think it's like the wind's blowing against the ground, but what's happening is...
The sound?
Nope, it's the ocean waves pounding against the shallow portion, you know, next to the continent. And that pounding can actually generate basically earthquakes up to, you know, so they say greater than 3.5 magnitude.
Remarkable.
Yeah.
That
the storms
really cool.
are powerful. Yeah. They specifically mentioned hurricanes or even nor'easters, like not even a hurricane level, just like a really strong nor'easter. If you have enough winds, it could, you know, the waves blowing it, crashing against the land, basically, can generate seismic activity in the earthquake range.
I guess that makes sense.
Yeah.
Who'd have thunk, though?
Pretty cool. Pretty cool. All right. Good job, guys.
Thanks,
Steve. Sorry, Bob.
Thanks.
Thank you. Whatever. Good job, Kara.
And Evan. Evan was started that
I sort of did, yes.
Yep.
Schmanky.
Good job, Evan.
You're welcome.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Smug bastards.
Every time you remember something, your mind changes it just a little. Until your best and your worst memories, they're your biggest illusions. This was said by Josephus Miller, Season 1, Episode 6 of The Expanse.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Now, is The Expanse something that you're covering on Alpha Quadrant 6?
Yep.
Awesome.
Yep, we reviewed it, and whenever the next season comes out, we'll review that too.
Next season is coming up. They're saying December 13th will be season four.
Four,
and
yep.
They will be producing a fifth season as well.
Great hard science fiction show. Very good.
Absolutely. And that was submitted by a listener from Iceland, who wishes to remain anonymous.
Iceland.
So thank you.
Anonymous Icelander.
I think he wanted to spare me the butchering of the pronunciation.
Yeah, he's like,
name.
Don't even bother reading
very,
my name.
Very, very kind of him or her.
Let's call him Jon Snow.
Yeah, I'll use that name.
All right. Thanks, Evan.
Thanks.
Well, thank you guys for joining me this week.
Fun show, Steve.
You're welcome, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.